I've been teaching beginners classes here in Nirota for a few years now. And I usually start the class by asking everybody who wants to share their reasons for coming to the class, reasons for being interested in meditation or mindfulness. And I find that some of the most common reasons for people to be interested in meditation are that they feel like they are just rushing through their lives. They are way too busy. They want to find a way to stop in the midst of all that busyness. They are feeling too tense or too restless. They would learn to relax, to calm down, to concentrate better. Some people have issues with anger. They want to work with that. Some people are suffering from depression or anxiety, and they have heard that meditation can help with that. Some people are living with chronic pain and are trying to find tools for living with that. I think what's common for all these reasons to be interested in meditation is that there is some suffering involved and wanting, a wish to alleviate that suffering. And this is what we can find in the heart of the Buddha's teachings. Dukkha is the Pali word that is often translated as suffering. It can also be translated as unsatisfactoriness or stress. And dukkha can refer to really intense forms of suffering, like really intense physical pain or mental pain. Or it can be much milder, can be really subtle sometimes. Just like having a feeling that things are not quite right here. Something more would be needed to fix this, but I'm not sure what it would be. And the Buddha, in his practice, before his enlightenment, wanted to find out what's behind suffering, what's causing suffering. And he found out these forces, these strong forces behind suffering. And two of these forces are referred to as greed and aversion. And it's these two forces that I'm going to talk about tonight in more detail to offer you some practical examples of greed and aversion so that you can get a sense of what is being talked about, what forms they can take in one's life and in one's practice. And I'm also going to talk a little bit about how to practice with greed and aversion when you encounter those, and what it would look like what a mind without any greed or aversion, what would it look like? And I'm going to start with greed and start with a practical example from my life from a few months ago. When my partner and I, we were visiting my grandmother who lives in Iisalmi, which is a city here in Finland, about 400 or 500 kilometers north of Helsinki. And we spent the night at a spa called Runni, which is in the countryside, outside of Iisalmi. And we arrived there in the evening and got a room in a so-called mansion hotel. They had converted this really old wooden mansion into a hotel. Our room was in there. And one of the first things we did was that we both meditated a little bit in our room. And as I was sitting there, I noticed how quiet it was there. It was just so very lovely and wonderful, like so quiet in there. Living here in Helsinki, there's always some kind of a background noise of a traffic there. We might not be aware of that because it's there basically all the time. But I was certainly aware of the absence of that there in the spa, in that mansion hotel. And I was like, it was a very enjoyable experience, the quietness and also the atmosphere of that old mansion and that room. So very enjoyable experience, but as I was sitting there, I noticed that what my mind did. Having practiced meditation for many years, I noticed that my mind really liked the experience. And almost right away started thinking about, like, how can I get more of this? Like, I want more of this. How can I get more of this? I'm wondering if they have spas like this closer to Helsinki. Like, I'm wondering if it's somewhere, if there's a place that's as quiet as this one, somewhere close to Helsinki, where I could go. And I'm wondering if there's a spa like that there somewhere. How would I get there since I don't have a car? Like, could I borrow a car from somebody for a whole weekend to get to that spa? Like, my mind went off like this, like really wanting more of that wonderful experience and trying to figure out how to get that. And I noticed that and brought my attention back to my body, back to my breathing, back to the pleasant sensations in the body and the mind. Staying there for a bit, and then going back to the wanting more of this and trying to figure out how to get more of this. Noticing that, bring the attention back to the body, back to the sensations, back to the pleasantness. And like going back and forth like that in the meditation session. But I think that if I hadn't practiced meditation, like what would have happened is that I'd probably spend a whole lot more of the time there in my thoughts, like being in this greedy, contracted state of mind, like I want more of this, how can I get more of this? Like instead of enjoying that pleasant experience at the spa, being caught in this contracted suffering state of mind of wanting more. And this is an example of greed or unwholesome desire. But before I say anything further, I want to clarify that not all desire is unwholesome. There are certainly wholesome desires there in our minds as well. And there's definitely nothing wrong with like wanting to take good care of yourself, wanting to take care of your well-being, going to a spa or going to a countryside every now and then. It's great if you're able to do that. But it's really critical for practice to become familiar with the difference between unwholesome desire and wholesome desire, and see the suffering that's there associated with the unwholesome desire or greed. It's like craving for chocolate, really wanting to get chocolate. And maybe you don't want to be wanting to get chocolate. Maybe you want the craving to stop, but you're not really in control. You might not be in control at all, and the craving for chocolate just goes on and on. Maybe you're not really able to concentrate on anything else very much. because of craving for chocolate, and eventually you might end up going to get the chocolate even though you might not want to go get it. Another reasonably common example of greed that I encounter in my life is when I'm reading novels or when I'm watching this something online video streaming services. Like I used to like detective stories, and I still do like detective stories, but I've noticed that I've been reading less and less of them, less and less of them. And I think a central reason behind that is that I actually at some point started noticing the suffering that was associated reading those detective stories. Like, what happens to me is that, like, I really want to know who the murderer is. I really want to know what happens next in the book. I really want to know if somebody else is going to die soon. I really want to know if people are going to get out of danger. And so it's this greedy state of mind, like wanting to know more. And then I end up maybe reading faster and faster and a bit too fast because of that. And if I have to stop reading for some reason, for instance, to go socialize or do something, do a chore, it's often the case that I'm not really able to concentrate well or enjoy the socializing because there's this wanting to get back to that detective story to find out who the murderer is. So I've noticed all this suffering, all these greed states of mind. And as a result, I haven't been reading that many detective stories anymore. And yeah, and these online video streaming services, they are really trying to build these series in such a way that at the end of each episode, there's some sort of cliffhanger that makes you want to see the next episode as soon as possible to make you kind of addicted to these video streaming services. They can be really great for relaxation, can be like necessary for relaxation sometimes, but there can be also these unwanted side effects, a lot of suffering as a result, as in my case. And then there are these grosser forms of greed, like wanting that certain job, or wanting that promotion, or wanting that raise, or wanting that relationship with that person, or wanting that holiday of the dreams, or wanting to get to sit a long retreat. And the problem with unwholesome desire is that it's not going to disappear, unfortunately, if you get what you wanted to get. Like, if you get your promotion, you might be content for a while. But pretty soon, with all likelihood, you're going to start wanting something else. Like, the energy of the greed is still there in your mind, and it's just going to be like targeting something else. Always targeting something else. Like, if you think back of your life, when you got something that you really wanted to get, like, how long did it last that you were contented with the situation? How long did it last before you started wanting something else? And yeah, greed makes you believe that getting what you're wanting is the answer to your problems. But it's unfortunately not true. And there's this great quote by Jim Carrey, the American actor, who says that, "I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see that it's not the answer." I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of, so they can see that it's not the answer. So it would be great if we could take this advice, really believe that, so that we wouldn't have to waste years or decades of our lives by trying to get what we want and only to notice that it wasn't the answer. Then a little bit about aversion. When I was originally writing this talk, I was sitting in the kitchen at home, and I started hearing sounds of a TV from a neighbor, not even a next door neighbor, like a bit farther away, a few apartments away. And I got frustrated, I got irritated, I got a bit worried, like there's this disturbance there, like this might not really be a good Dharma talk if I'm like being disturbed while I'm writing it. I should be able to concentrate better here. And I could feel my mind and my body tensing up, kind of like trying to protect me from the sound, from the disturbance, as if that would help. But like really feeling in that situation, clearly feeling the aversion and how it was in the body and in the mind, like somehow kind of like tensing up and trying to make that disturbance disappear and go away. Or there's this another example, very common example from my life. I live about 9 minutes from a train station, from a local train station, and I walk there back and forth once or twice almost every day. And I've been doing so for years, so it's been hundreds and hundreds of times walking that same stretch of road. And quite often when I'm doing that, I'm like so tired of that, I'm so bored of that. I might be hungry, I might be sleepy, I might be wanting to get back home. There might be so much unpleasantness in my experience, like not this again, like 9 minutes of this. I've seen this so many times before. I don't want to be here. So a lot of aversion in the mind and the body once again. And what happens to me in that situation, like there's again like kind of like contraction happening and narrowing of attention and like thinking about anything but what's happening in the present moment. And if I see, sometimes when I see that happening, if I spot the aversion, there might be a letting go of that and kind of opening up and relaxing and like starting to notice the surroundings. And sometimes there's been like, wow, it's actually quite beautiful here. Like, look at all the snow and the glittering of snow. It's actually quite beautiful here. And even if it's not beautiful, it might sometimes be like totally really ugly, like in November. But even if the experience is unpleasant, both internally and externally, might still feel like if there's been a letting go of aversion, like, oh, I really, really want to be here for this moment of my life. Like, I really want to be here for this moment of my life, even though it's unpleasant. But I wouldn't change this for anything. This is so much better than being lost in thought. And with aversion, it's really important to remember that, like, no sensation that we have, no experience that we have is inherently wrong or bad or problematic. It's the aversion that tells us that there is something wrong with our experience. It's not the voice of some sort of an absolute truth. It's the voice of aversion that tells us that there is something wrong with our experience. And our life would be so much easier if we didn't believe that voice of that aversion. It might simply not be true that there is a problem here in this situation that needs to be fixing somehow. I remember when I started getting experiences of this on retreats. Once I was on one retreat, I was feeling quite anxious and kind of nervous too. A lot of aversion to that. But for some reason, at some point, that aversion fell away by itself. And I was still feeling anxious and nervous and unpleasant, but the aversion wasn't there anymore. There actually wasn't any kind of a problem with that situation. And like, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling unpleasant, but I want to be living this moment of my life. I want to be here for this moment of my life. So when we look at our experience in our meditation, we can see again and again the sequence of events. We experience a sensation. It might be a physical sensation in our body. It might be a sound, something visual. It might be we are tasting something or smelling something. Might be a thought, it might be a mind state that we are experiencing. And whatever the sensation is, there's usually a feeling tone associated with that sensation. So we experience the sensation either as pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. For instance, right now I'm feeling some coldness on my hand, and that registers in my mind as slightly unpleasant. But what really often happens is that there is a reaction to this feeling tone. So if we are experiencing something unpleasant, our mind might automatically react with aversion, with like wanting to get rid of that source of unpleasantness. And if we are experiencing something pleasant, our mind might react by wanting more of that, or wanting to hold on to that pleasant thing. Or if we experience something neutral, our mind might react with boredom or restlessness. Like, nothing interesting here now. And as a result of this reactivity, there might be like tensing up and contracting and all these trains of thought starting. Like, how can I get more of this? How can I arrange my life so that I can get more of this? Or how can I arrange my life so that I can get rid of this something? And it's so fascinating to see this process over and over again. This especially critical part of the process, this feeling tone, this vedana in the Pali language. Like, it's so quick. It's so small, it's so fleeting. Something feels unpleasant or pleasant or neutral. And yet it has such a great impact on our lives. This tiny, tiny, fleeting thing. But But fortunately, there are times when we are free of greed and aversion. It's really possible to experience those moments too, and hopefully the more we practice, the more we get to experience those moments of equanimity. Like while we might be experiencing pleasantness, like enjoying our stay at a spa, but without any unwholesome desire there in our minds, we might be experiencing something unpleasant like anxiety, but without any aversion associated with that. And I want to emphasize that equanimity doesn't mean that we are somehow really passive or feeling indifferent, like just doormats in our life, like totally accepting anything and not trying to change anything. It doesn't work like that. Like it's often really wise to to act in life and to act in the world. Like if you're in an abusive relationship, it might be a really good idea to do something about the situation instead of like trying to train yourself to accept the abuse that you're experiencing. So equanimity doesn't mean indifference. And if you're feeling equanimous, you're still able to act, but then you're acting. You have the chance to act from wisdom or from compassion or from love instead of from that reactivity of that greed and aversion. And it's a very, very different motivation for action in the world. And equanimity doesn't mean that it's not the same thing as being calm or relaxed or mindful either, you know, because it's certainly possible to be like, for instance, feeling restless or stressed and feeling equanimous about that, like no problem with feeling stressed. It's fine. What I find interesting is that, like in the first years of my practice, when I heard talks about equanimity, it was like one of the most boring topics for me. I remember my reaction to those talks, like, oh my God, do I have to listen to another talk on equanimity? Like, couldn't be less interesting. And it was because I really didn't get like what was being pointed at. But later on, as I was starting to get experiences that myself, like, started to see how like really important and wonderful that is. And as my teacher Greg Scharf puts it, what could be better than equanimity? Something that he says every now and then. What could be better than equanimity? What could be better than a mind that's free of all internal struggle? And an image that's commonly used for equanimity is a mountain. It's a mountain that doesn't budge no matter what's going on. No matter what's going on around the mountain. Like there are all these worldly winds blowing in our lives. Like one moment we might be joyful. Another moment we might be experiencing grief. Sometimes we succeed, sometimes we fail. Sometimes it feels like everybody likes us. Sometimes it feels like nobody likes us. Like our life is in constant change. And it will be till the very end. there's gonna be pleasantness there, there's gonna be unpleasantness there. It's talked about 10,000 sorrows and 10,000 joys of life. And equanimity is like that mountain, like no matter what kind of winds are blowing, the mountain doesn't budge. Now, a question might arise, like, what should I do to be like that mountain? What should I do to be equanimous, to get equanimous as quickly as possible? But unfortunately, it's not possible to just turn on the equanimity. It would be really nice if it was, but it's not. And it's there's a risk there, like if you really want to be equanimous, if you really want to get equanimous, there's a greed involved there, like I really want to get equanimous. And if there's greed involved there, you're actually going to the opposite direction of equanimity. So that's not the that's not the means to get there. Basically, our standard Vipassana meditation practice is enough to develop equanimity. Burmese meditation master Sayadaw Utejaniya, in one of his books, Don't Look Down on the Defilements, he has this image that I really like. It illustrates the development of equanimity really well, I think. So it's an image of a washing machine. And it looks really like a washing machine. And there are some t-shirts in the washing machine. And there are also some t-shirts drying, hanging on the clothesline. And the t-shirts have, all the t-shirts have something written on the chest, the front. And the t-shirt could say, for instance, greed. Another t-shirt could say aversion. Another one could say pride. Yet another one might say I or me. And as he put these t-shirts in the washing machine, the writing on the t-shirt fades. So you get this faded version of greed, you get this faded version of aversion. And after the t-shirts have been to the washing machine for many, many times, at some point there's not going to be any writing left on the t-shirts. It's just going to be blank white t-shirts without any greed or aversion anywhere. And that is kind of how, like, our Vipassana practice works. Like, again and again, we are observing our sensations, the sensations in our awareness, like physical sensation, sound, another physical sensation, no thought. We are observing the feeling tones, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, associated with those sensations. And we are observing that reactivity of greed and aversion. And after we have seen this quite a few times, and we have seen the suffering that's involved in there, in all that reactivity, it starts to fade, the suffering starts to fade, and the greed and the aversion start to fade. And is it possible to trust that process? That we don't really need to do anything more special than to observe what's going on? But there is actually, if we are interested in other kinds of practices, if we are interested in bringing this topic to the forefront of our attention, there are some things that we could do in our practice, in our formal practice. So it's really essential to notice that reactivity of the mind, to notice the greed and aversion in our mind, in our system. And we can use those questions that I introduced in the guided meditation. We can use them in our formal meditation sessions, or we can use them in the midst of our daily life. We can ask ourselves, is there something I would like to have, something more right now? Or is there something I would like to get rid of right now? And if we spot some greed or aversion, like really feeling into it, like really feeling how does it feel like in the system, like how does it feel in the mind, in the heart, in the body? Can we feel that contraction that's there? Can we feel that suffering that's there? And you might be able to let go of greed and aversion if you notice them, or you might not. And it's quite common that it's letting go doesn't really work, so it's better not try not to force that in any way. Try to see if it's possible to accept the presence of the greed or the aversion without adding any new layers of greed and aversion. They're like aversion to the greed, or aversion to the aversion to the greed that's there. And another practice that I really like is to like use tension of the mind or struggle in the mind as a mindfulness spell. So live your days, live your life, and notice if there is a tension in your mind at some point, if there's struggle in your mind at some point. And if you find something like that, it's an indication that there might be greed or aversion present there. But besides greed and aversion, it's really important also to notice the absence of them. Notice the moments of equanimity and really allow ourselves to enjoy those moments of equanimity, because they might be a really important motivators for our practice to come. And I want to end my talk tonight with a poem. It's a poem by Nyoshul Kempo Rinpoche. It's a poem that I really like, and it works especially well for me in situations where I feel a little bit overwhelmed. Like I might be feeling there's so much greed and so much aversion, so much reactivity there in the mind that there's no hope here, it's just too much. Like all these patterns of the mind, it's just too strong, it's just too much. This poem often helps me. And it goes, rest in natural great peace, this exhausted mind, beaten helpless by karma and neurotic thoughts, like the relentless fury of the pounding waves in the infinite ocean of samsara. Rest in natural great peace. Let us sit quietly for a moment.